Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I would say 90% of the artists that you may speak with will name at least 5 records that they regret ever recording.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 209, a talk with DJ Toomp. Aldrin DJ Toomp Davis began his career as a DJ and producer for early Atlanta rap acts like Raheem the Dream and MC Shy D. But it was when he met a friend's cousin named Clifford Harris that things really got started. Harris rapped under the name Tip, which he would later change to T.I. to avoid confusion, after signing to the same record label as Q-Tip. T.I. and Toomp would together sell millions of records, create classics, and even help start a whole new genre. An entire generation in Atlanta and beyond would take inspiration from the sound and title of Toomp and T.I.'s 2003 album Trap Music, and a style bearing that name would come into being. But that's far from the end of Toomp's accomplishments. He also, as you'll hear, played a key role in the creation of Kanye West's 2007 album Graduation, and a whole lot more besides. We talked to Toomp at his hotel in New York City. If you enjoy The Cipher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecipher show. It bought us these sweet leather vests, and we've recently updated our rewards with some great new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the man who taught us about both trap music and the good life, DJ Toomp. So I got to say, I was disappointed a little bit when you came down into the lobby. You were not wearing the outfit from the Can't Say I Love You video, the vest and no shirt. That was a great look.
I was just a dog out for the cat. You were fine, but your face wasn't all that. But when you caught my eye, I made the best of it and told myself, hey, she wanna get hit.
Hey, man.
Classic look.
Yo, listen, man. That ain't none of your business, man. I don't know why you are over there, man. Gee whiz. Yo, don't you know, man, some people ask me about that. They'd be like, what was the name of that song? And I do not help them at all. It's like, I don't want you YouTubing and pulling that shit, man. Yeah, but nah, that's some of that old school, man. It's good. It's amazing, too. I was just looking on the internet. And they were saying that they were thinking about doing a bio with 2 Live Crew, you know, and Luke and them. I think that should be a pretty interesting story, man, because I was there. I witnessed at least, I'd say, 70% of their story.
Early in his career, Toomp worked with MC Shy D, who was signed to Luke Records, the label run by 2 Live Crew's Luther Campbell. Shy D, a Bronx native who was actually Afrika Bambaataa's cousin, was one of Atlanta's first successful artists. He put out his first single in 1985 and signed with Luke in 1986. Even after Shy D left the label, Toomp stayed on, DJing for other acts. He even did a duo album with 2 Live Crew member Brother Marquise as Too Nasty, an album that contains tracks like Can't Say I Love You and Somebody Say Ho.
You were a kid, right? You were just out of high school, maybe?
Yeah, fresh out of high school, man. Yeah, just fresh out of high school. Because it's wild, because I had never left Georgia, period, until I got with MC Shady. You know, I won a DJ battle, and I was DJing a college step show at the same area. It was Atlanta Civic Center. And I guess since he heard about me doing college events, and, you know, he thought I was out of school. Mm. He was like, hey, man, I want another DJ on the road. Came to the DJ battle. Well, he came to the step show. I was like, hey, you know, how can we catch up? And I'm all excited. Like, damn, that's MC Shy D, you know. He came to the house. My mom was like, yeah, so are y'all, what, y'all going to do some shows and come back, you know, by Sunday? Because, you know, you got to be at school first thing Monday, you know. It was about 4 more months until I graduated, you know what I mean? And I'm like, no, mom, I want to get a tutor. But the thing about it, the schedule was like a 2 month long tour. I think about a good 3 weeks straight. You know what I mean? And you know, I was used to just doing shows and coming back home the next day.
Right.
You know, just touring with some of my previous artists like Raheem the Dream and a few others.
Tomb started working with Atlanta rapper Raheem the Dream back when the producer was just a teenager. Their first track together was 1986's The Raheem Twins.
Yeah, man. And when he showed me that schedule, I was like, oh, my God. And first thing my mom said, oh, y'all getting on an airplane? He was like, yeah, how you think we're going to get to California? You know? And mom was like, ooh, I don't know about that. You know, because she had never flown either, you know. My mom, wow, rest in peace. She never wanted to get on an airplane. She didn't want to do too much. So my family didn't do too much traveling. So, yeah, man. And that was my first time ever flying. First time leaving Georgia. And just really, you know, going out there and taking this music thing, you know, head to head, you know. And I went out there, man, and everything was beautiful. I said, here you go. I'm right here.
Yeah. So what was it like being 18, 19 and being around 2 Live Crew?
Man, listen, man, I can write an excellent book on that one. It may be coming in the next few years, too. But, man, first of all, I'm going to tell you, it was funny because I didn't understand, you know, the whole tour thing, you know, after party at the hotel, lobby full of women. You know what I mean? I really didn't understand that. I thought they were just there to kick it. I thought they were just fans, you know. I used to have about 4 or 5 girls in my room. They were just talking about the show or whatever. And I just sit in there, I hook the drum machine up and just be having fun in the room. And then later on, the older guy was like, hey, man, what you doing? Like, you know, you're supposed to be knocking these women off. You know what I mean? You know, I'm fresh out of high school, man. I'm used to having to, you know, have a little convo, you know, before I, you know, get to know a woman. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I was fresh on the road, man. I was a little youngin' out there. So I caught on later on. But it almost turned me into a whore, but I disciplined myself. It was a hell of a lifestyle, though. I must say.
And so some of the stuff you did on Skywalker Records was that record with Bust Down. Ah. He was almost as nasty as 2 Live Crew.
Yeah, you've done your research, yeah, man. Nasty bitch.
Nasty bitch.
In addition to Mike Fresh that Toop mentioned here, Ice Mike produced 2 tracks on the album, the title track Nasty Bitch and Put Your Ballies On.
What was making that record like?
That was cool, man. My man Mike Fresh, who I produced the Shadi stuff with, he called me in on that project, you know, since we already made Fire with Shadi, and then we did some stuff on the New Jack City soundtrack. Tony Rock, you know what I mean? So he brought me in on that, man. And, you know, he was like, yo, I got a dude Luke just signed from Marrero, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And I guess he put Marrero on the map, too, because a lot of his stuff is still like classic in Louisiana. You know,
wow.
Nasty Bitch and a lot of that stuff. So it was decent, man. Because, you know, he had a fresh little new style. You know what I mean? As far as totally different from everything else that Luke had on the label. And that's the good thing about Luke's, you know, Luke was reaching out. He had a dude... what was the guy's name? He was from California. Like, he wasn't just one of those labels who was just trying to sign all Florida people. You know what I mean? He had Professor Griff.
Y'all and all better get ready. Listen to me. Listen.
Luke signed Public Enemy's controversial Minister of Information, Professor Griff, in the early 90s. You can hear Campbell talk about it during our interview with him on episode 116.
He had a man Society. He had a group called The Talk that was out of Texas. And MC Twist, that's the name of guy out of California. So he just had a variety of artists from everywhere. You know, he was really, really a true, true label. You know what I mean?
You work with Poison Clan some?
Yes, sir.
You toured with them?
I toured with them. I was really in the original group. Like, if you watch the Dance All Night video, I was like the DJ.
Make a change of plan and do what's only right. Just get on the floor and dance all night.
And what's crazy, I never really got a chance to produce, but I was just DJing and on the road. I was in the Poison Clan. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. Because on the cover of the 2 Nasty record, it says from 2 Live Crew and from Poison Clan.
Yeah.
Were you happy about the 2 Nasty record? We started off talking about it.
It was cool, you know what I mean? Because one thing I can say, I learned a lot. You know, my homeboy, it was me, Brother Marquise, and my homeboy, Daryl Jones. He decided to move from Miami and to come to Atlanta. And we started a label, Down Payment Records. And actually, I learned a whole lot, you know, just being around, you know, around Daryl. And just, we all learned a lot, just even being a record label and paying taxes and all that stuff. You know what I mean? Because my man, he came from a tax-free, you know, worlds. You know what I mean? You know, guys were getting their money. It's a whole lot we learned, man. And some of the records, you know, it's nothing I would play for my daughter to this day. You know what I mean?
I think that whole Skywalker Records era, maybe.
I wouldn't want her to pull up none of that shit, man. You know what I mean? It's, you know, it's amazing how things change when you have a kid, and especially a daughter.
Right.
Yeah, it was just a phase, you know, just trying to reach and really find your spot and your lane out here in this business, man. And you can... I would say 90% of the artists that you may speak with will name at least 5 records that they regret ever recording. You feel me?
Yeah. And yeah, a lot of them have histories that maybe they don't talk about, you know, early stuff.
And some, definitely when it comes to that, because I always make a joke about Lawrence Fishburne, man. You know, he might catch up and get on my ass about this, but it's funny because a lot of folks don't know his character in the Pee-wee's Playhouse when he was Cowboy Curtis.
How's your wiener doing, Cowboy Curtis? Well, just a little bit overcooked, but that's just the way I like it. How's your wiener, Pee-wee?
Perfect!
Well, good. Let's eat.
And I noticed in his interviews, he never mentioned that shit. Like, I think he tells his people, like, hey, whatever y'all do, y'all can talk about my Cornbread Earl and me and everything else, but do not mention Pee-wee's Playhouse. You know what I mean? So, yeah, everybody got their little thing that they just really regret, you know. But like I say, it's a part of the journey, man. It plays its part.
Yeah. It's funny, man. One of the things with Skywalker Records that connects directly to Shy D, something I was listening to on the way here, was She Put Me in a Trance.
Tony MF Rock. Hell yeah. I still talk to Tony, man. Good dude.
Girl asked me to dance. I looked at her body, went into a trance.
Yo, my man, since you went into a trance, what was you kicking, homeboy?
She put me in a trance by the way she moved those thighs.
Yo, how was you feeling?
That's amazing. So tell me about the
bass
Tony
guitar
Rock.
Flare, right?
Yeah. So tell me about the Tony Rock records that She Put Me in a Trance and then the other one that was kind of
still
about.
Still doing it. Yeah, basically, around that time, you know, because Shadi, you know, he kept it real basic, you know, straight flow, real straightforward. But Shadi wasn't a super, super lyrical guy. He just knew how to make great records and a great entertainer on top of that. But Tony Rock, when we brought him, that was more of us saying, yeah, we got a lyricist now. We got somebody who we can run neck and neck with the New York cats. You know what I mean? And even Luke saw the same thing that we saw in him. Like, damn, you know, that dude really knows how to, you know, rap. And yeah, he brought something different to the table. You know, he had his album, Tony MF Rock. He had a song called, man, there's a few of them on there. The one about his homeboy committing suicide.
Yo, hold up, my brother. Before you sell out, think about this, son. That's far too many girls to kill yourself over one. Don't go out like a sucker.
He made some dope records, you know what I mean? It was an experience, man, just bringing... there's another group called... it was a few groups that we just brought to the label. Because
mm-hmm.
we were actually in a position, believe it or not, me, Mike, and Shadi, we was kind of like in an A&R's position. Because whenever we run into something hot in Atlanta, we would just hit Luke, like, you know, hey, man, you know, can we bring our artists down here? If you like them, boom, sign them. And that's how it was with Tony Rock. You know, we just gave him a chance, like, hey... Just like Mike Fresh, they brought Devastator, who produced Shake What Your Mama Gave You and I Wanna Rock.
Kenneth, Devastator Terry produced Shake What Your Mama Gave You for Poison Clan and I Wanna Rock for Luke.
We just knew he was a hot producer. We're like, hey, man, we'll bring you down to Miami with us and give you a shot at it. Yeah, wow. So we were really like A&Rs and didn't even know it.
And so that label you started around 92 or so, how did that go?
Down Payment?
Yeah.
It was cool. We had a group called Native Nuts.
I was going to ask about them later on. Yeah,
man.
They were
and,
wild.
First hip-hop album I could truly say I thoroughly produced from top to bottom. On some Manny Fresh type shit, you know what I mean?
So the unusual thing about that album, at least for people who know you now, is it's very New York underground backpack early 90s.
I'm 18, the 28th of November. The name is Native Nuts, act like Mike can remember. 40 ounces of funk, 40 ounces of funk.
You know, I think you mentioned Lords of the Underground and all this stuff that was happening at the same time.
That's right.
Was it kind of just a thing of, I want to show that I can do that too?
Yes. Because, you know, they brought that, you know, that was their style, basically. And I was like, you know what? I have those kind of beats. I can make those type of beats, you know, without the drum rolls and 808. And around that time, man, I mean, we always had BET on, you know. So around the 90s, you know, if you got Rap City on, and that was back when BET was just running videos all day. So while most producers were making beats, they either had their TV on or on mute.
I should note that you have BET jams on mute right now as we're talking. Right now, yeah,
man, and that's where we come from. Yeah. Man. And by the time, you know, when I met those guys, man, I think, oh, damn, how did I meet Joey and Lee Mill and them? I think we was at an event and they was like, yo, man, you need to listen to us, man. We got some cool shit. Native Nuts. And when I heard it, it was dope. And I brought them to the house because that's when me, Daryl, and Marquise had a crib out there in Stone Mountain with a little studio set up in there. And man, I say we cut like 3 songs in one day, just meeting, you know what I mean? Matter of fact, I think we met at some music conference. I don't know if it was Jack the Rapper. It might have been one of the last Jack the Rappers. That's when I met those guys. Lee Mill, Dorier, he's sitting down right now. Hopefully he'll be out soon. Mm-hmm. But my man Joey Joe, Joseph Davis, man, he's from, forgot what part of North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. But they just had that East Coast flow. And man, I shift, you know, I could shift into any mode when it comes to production. Right. And even back then, man, I thoroughly gave them dudes a straight up hip hop album. It's a classic. I still see people on YouTube giving me shout outs about it. Like, damn, Toom, you produced this whole joint, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, we signed them to the label and it went pretty well.
Speaking of Jack the Rapper, Two Live Crew got pretty wild at some of those. Were you there?
What you mean?
With Shogun stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a hell of a story, man. I was there. It was me, JT, because that was when JT Money and them had a song, Cowards in Compton. Him right. And my man, Clay Vassier.
I put a trigger, nigga, and turn off your lights. Yeah, fuck ass, nigga, you just don't know. Nigga, know about your motherfucking ass with them turn off the light days. Nigga, when you sitting on them outcuts with the motherfucking lip gloss and them sequins outfits on. Nigga, I know what a nigga want you to do right now. Nigga, you know what I want you to do for me right now? I want you to just take off that G-string, baby.
And earlier that day, some L.A. dudes said some real slick shit to JT. And JT was like, hey, Luke, you know, I think it's about to pop off. We was at the Marriott downtown. And Luke, he had a few of his Miami cats up here with him. It was him, Run May, and some other cats. Yeah, Run May, hella cool dude. He run around with Flo Rida right now. That's my man. But me and him go all the way back to those days. And I would say within 3 hours, man, there were about 200 guys from Miami. Some drove. Well, they couldn't drove in 2 hours, but a lot of them flew. Well, I would say that was in the early part of the day. But I would say however long it took for certain people to drive there, they drove, but half of them flew. Mm-hmm. But it was at least 200 guys from Miami ready to go. Yeah, man, they couldn't handle that, man. The LA dudes, they was definitely about their business, but they didn't know how many down south, you know, straight Miami guys had and came to town. And yeah, it was crazy, man. I watched the whole thing. Like, we was upstairs going up the elevator. We was up the escalator. And at the Marriott, you could just see everybody come in. So we saw the West Coast dudes, and we saw the Miami dudes, everybody coming at the same time. So the Miami dudes start clapping like, yeah, like, you know, like a football team. Like, here we go. And I was like, oh, shit, here it is, y'all. And, man, it went crazy, man. You just see, what's the little joints, man, when they have the little velvet joints that they have, like, VIP areas?
Oh, just the rope top. So the rope,
yeah,
stuff
the velvet
off.
Ropes.
Yeah.
Well, the main little base that they sit on,
yeah.
Man, you just saw those flying everywhere. Oh, yeah. People got hurt, man. Yeah. It was no problem after that, though, man. The Miami dudes. It was crazy, man. They actually ended up getting cool after that, man. There was no more problems, man, with West Coast and Miami. It was super smooth after that. Yeah,
amazing.
Man. Yeah, those were some great times, man. Pac, the whole Dr. Dre, everybody. It's like everybody was alive, too. You know what I mean?
Right. You had an L.A. guy actually play a big part in your career earlier than that, Bobcat.
Yes, man. Wow, you've done some serious research, huh?
Yeah. So tell me about him. You met him through DJing stuff when you were doing more competitive DJing?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It was in 86. I was, it's a guy named Darryl Baptiste, man, who's from LA. And he came down to Atlanta and promoted a few shows. We used to call him Big Daddy Darryl. He had a DJ battle at the skating rink on Metropolitan now. It used to be Stewart Avenue. I came like in second place. I think my homeboy DJ Daz came in first. And I end up teaming up with DJ Daz later on. That's crazy. But so Darryl was like, yo, man, you know, I'm going to bring this guy to Atlanta, man. Y'all need to check him out. He's a fool. Like, he's, you know, he run around with the Egyptian Lover and the Cat Crew. He called him Bobcat. And, man, he threw this event. like in Southwest Atlanta, and Bobcat got on the turntables. He had on a ninja suit. And that was our first time just even watching, seeing a DJ move that fast. That shit just changed our lives. Me, my boy Daz, and another dude named Chauncey. And we was like a three-man DJ crew. And man, after we saw him and he was here for like a whole week, he was like, yo, you know, he introduced us to him. And we was sitting there looking at him like, oh, like, get the fuck out of here. Man, you getting ready to really change our life. So he started scratching his times at a 45, just showing speed. And that's when we start adding more speed and agility to our DJ routines. And we kept in touch, man. And Bob, you know, he'll come by the crib. You know, we'll work out on the tables. He'll show me a few tricks. And one day, I think around, 86, right when he was like, man, I got to catch a flight back to L.A., man. Believe it or not, I'm about to work with LL Cool J. And I'm like, word? LL? He's like, yeah, man, I'm telling you, man, I'm producing and everything, you know, doing the beats. You know, and that's when I really started understanding, like, okay, I'm making beats, but you're talking about really true production. You know what I mean? Like creating, you know, music and everything. Because he's telling me he knew how to play keys and stuff. So I really didn't know anything about playing keys. I worked a few drum machines. And when I saw the I'm Bad video, and that shit came out,
yeah.
And when I saw him on the turntables, I was like, oh, yeah, I got to step it up. It's time to I want to get into the real side of this, man. And then LL went on tour. It came to the Omni Arena, and man, I caught up with Bobcat backstage, man. He was like, hell yeah. You know, he had on his raccoon hat. Man, it was just dope, man. Like, it changed my life, and that made me really, really want to get into, like, that side of the music industry on a major level. Bob was definitely an inspiration.
What was your best DJ trick when you were doing competitions?
Oh, setting the records on fire.
Okay, so I heard you say that in an interview, and I thought you were speaking euphemistically, like, oh, I used to set the records on fire
because
I
was such a hot DJ, like a figure of speech, right? Oh, yeah. Nah. No? Physically, yeah. People still say they want to see me do that trick because I did it at Jelly Beans a few times, and I did it on the road with a few people. Just a little trick. I get the lighter fluid put on there. And Rockmaster Scott, it's a song called The Roof is on fire.
The roof is on fire. We don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. Burn, motherfucker, burn. The roof
is on fire. Hey girls, B-boys. So I used to backspin, fire, just, you know, showing my speed, fire. Then I scratch it, chicka. It had a lighter fluid on there. Fire. And so next thing you know, when I light it, you'll just see the blue flame come up and the crowd used to go crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, that shit was crazy.
How did you first figure out you could do that? I feel like it'd be something I'd be scared to experiment
on. Believe
it
or not, my man DJ Daz, he had showed me, because first I was using alcohol. And one time, I ain't gonna lie, I put too much alcohol on it and almost like fucked everything up.
Right.
You know, of course, you know, and luckily alcohol burns and dries out fast to where the fire didn't last that long. And he was like, nah, man, just get lighter fluid and drop it on the paper, the label part of the record.
Oh,
and what
so
that
just
does,
that ends
it's,
up
it's
burning.
A temporary, is this a real, yeah, it's, and it's a real controllable flame at that point that could still be seen from a distance. You feel
right.
me? Yeah, it was crazy, man. But I had to work my way from alcohol and then finally understanding just a few drips of lighter fluid could get the same effect in a more safe manner.
DJs out there, if you do the trick, you've got to give credit.
Yeah. Do not try gasoline, gentlemen.
Oh, my God. So you have this whole early era of your career.
Yeah.
Raheem the Dream and then Shy D and this whole time Miami. Why leave Miami? Why go back to Atlanta?
Well, actually, man, the Miami scene was cool. I was just down there selling tracks, you know, 1,500, some for 2,000. It was college for me, actually, because I didn't understand anything about publishing, licensing, to the point where they're like, okay, man, we like that beat. How much you want? Like 1,500. All right, here you go. You got to sign this paper. So I thought that was just a signed paper just to get the check. I didn't know I was signing all my rights, like work for hire.
Yeah.
You know, just a little young guy, you know, 18, 19 years old, just hustling. You know what I mean? I was down there back and forth for like 5 years. Shadi had gotten into a situation where he had to go sit down for a minute. And I was still kind of dealing with Luke and them, me and Mike Fresh. And my man, Rodney Terry, Cool Collie, one of the Ghost Town DJs. And we were still down there moving around. After a while, man, I think around 90, I started DJing for Poison Clan. We were back and forth on the road. I started saving my money or whatnot. But then I ended up meeting this guy, DJ Magic Mike. Yeah, which was through my man Clay D. And once I sat with Magic Mike and he started telling me, like, you know, I noticed that he was doing very well. You know, he was co-owner of his label with Tom Wright, Cheetah Records. And they was going gold and platinum, independent, no major distribution at all. Rich as hell, you hear me? Getting it. So he just started asking me a lot of questions that I couldn't answer. He was like, man, so, you know, what's your publishing company now? You know about licensing and all that? And I was like, nah. He was like, bro, you got to educate yourself on it. That's how I got this far. And I just started buying books, man, and understanding what I'm really supposed to get. And I was like, you know what, man? Now that I'm on a whole new mission and I get it, and I really understand, you know, how to get all my residuals. And I'm hearing that shit is popping in Atlanta. Atlanta, you know, 85, 86, 87, we had a cool scene, but it didn't really pop off until, we had Itchy Bun Records or whatnot. A few people was doing good. Jermaine Dupri was always doing pretty well. You know, his dad brought him in very smooth, Silver Spoon style.
Jermaine Dupri's father, Michael Molden, ran a successful tour management company in the 70s and 80s and later served as president of Columbia Records. You can hear Jermaine talk about his father during our interview with him on episode 167.
And he's doing well to this day. I love JD, man. I got a book by one by Kashif about the music business. What was the other one? By Donald Passman.
Donald Passman's book, All You Need to Know About the Music Business, is used as a textbook in many colleges and universities, including Sean's alma mater, Berklee College of Music.
And I just educated myself. I didn't thoroughly go through it. I went to the chapters that was necessary, basically, you know, and that was just basic royalties, publishing, and residuals, and sync fees, and understanding, you know, when a song goes to a movie, because I got jerked out of that New Jack City,
right?
Yeah, that shit sold 3 million, and all I got was 1500 for the track. You feel me?
Yeah.
And
that was kind of a strange Two Live Crew song too.
Taking this shit into the effect mode, expressing my feelings before I explode about the suffering that's on to a black man by the money hungry seeking white man.
It's a great tune, but it's
totally different, right?
Very different feel.
Yeah, because we had to, you know, and that was more, you know, coming like a East Coast type album with a little hip hop on it. So, yeah, we decided not to give them no booty shake. You know, it just needed to be something. And it was kind of like a political record, because that's when Luke had this part talking about, you know, we don't fly planes and, you know, drugs into the country. The government do, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen a black man come in to Miami with pounds and pounds of marijuana, pounds and pounds of cocaine. You have never seen a black man drop off a kilo load of cocaine out of a plane. You have never seen this, but yet and still it's in our community every day, and we're the ones going to jail for it.
The system is designed to leave.
Freeway Ricky shit, you know what I mean? And yeah, man, and we delivered something real nice. But from that album selling 3 million, and later on, like I say, after I read few chapters in the book, man, and I was like, yo, I'm supposed to have a bag, like a serious bag. You feel me? And that was college for me, man. You know, moved that tassel to the side, took my ass back to Atlanta, stayed with my parents for a minute. And like I say, later on, that's when we started down payment. And around 97, I ran into Tony Mercedes, and he was like, yo, you know, I got a opportunity to get some songs on a Dr. Dolittle soundtrack, which was my first royalty check ever in my career.
What were the tracks? Do you remember?
It was a song called Push 'Em Up. It wasn't even a single. It just happened to be one record on a triple platinum album.
Who was the artist?
It was Eddie Kane and DeVille. I don't even think they rap anymore. Yeah, these guys out of Decatur. I produced the record. Me and these twins, I can't think of their name. Thing about it, man, that was my first time ever doing real business. You know what I mean? Mm. With the black and white, you know, once you get the black and white right, the green is going to be, it's going to flow perfect. Yeah. And so, man, yeah, I got my first royalty check and publishing and all that, man. And it was amazing, man, just to see what I really was supposed to be getting when I was younger.
All these years.
Yeah, man. Right. And so I get it now. And it was no turning back since then, man.
one very important question mm-hmm. about your relationship with T.I., since that happens right around this time period, around 97.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the better barber, you or him?
Yeah, it was me. Yeah. Tip was pretty good with the fade. I watched him knock a few guys off up at Toot's barbershop, man. And rest in peace, Toot, man. He's definitely the bridge that brought me and Tip together, because he had been bragging about his little cousin for a whole year. And I finally took a chance to listen, man. And I was blown away.
What did his tape sound like, the first demo? Obviously, it wasn't on your beats. It was on his beats.
Yeah, it was on his beats. Yeah, it was dope, man. It was like a whole lot of little organs. You could tell he was influenced by a lot of UGK.
Mm.
And it was him and the rest of the PSC.
Yeah.
You know, you heard Doug on a few. You heard Big Country and Mac Boney and the rest of them. But when it got to his verse, I always be like, oh, who the hell is that? He was like, yeah, that's me. After he said that on about 5 or 6 different records, I was like, you know, we got to work on you first.
Right.
The other guys are going to come later. I know those are your boys. That's your crew. We got to focus on you. Like, you're that guy. You're the one that's catching my ear right now from this whole cassette.
The organ, that was his influence. That was his idea. That was there from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were kind of influenced by that, because that was kind of like, you know, that UGK stuff was real popping at that point. So, yeah, it was real funky. That was his, yeah. He liked a lot of organs.
Yeah, that was obviously a big part of his sound. How'd you hook up with KP?
I've been knowing KP for a while when he was DJing for this group PA, Parental Advisory.
Oh, yeah, in the sort of greater circle of Outkast.
Yep. And they were signed to Pebbles label. Mm. And they had a pretty cool little run and whatnot. But then KP ended up being the A&R at LaFace. And so after me and Tip met, you know, started working, I was basically like, hey, man, we need some management. I'm a producer. I know I make it wear a management jacket, but that's not really my thing.
Yeah.
And so I hooked him up with Jason. I introduced him to Jason.
The Jason Toot mentions here is Jason Jeter, T.I.'s longtime manager and business partner.
Jason was like, dude, you know, yeah, we need to all team up and make this happen. And so Jason was working at Patchwork at the time. He was working on the front desk, you know, just doing his thing around there. Interning, basically, at the old Patchwork.
A super gift like a looper with a Ruger, Jumpman in a past life. Maybe I was future super nigga.
Patchwork is a well-known recording studio in Atlanta. They also had an affiliated label for a little over a decade, something we discussed during our interview with Razzkaz in episode 186.
And I think when KP came through, I think KP was working with some stuff with doing stuff with Youngbloods and maybe a little stuff with PA also, because he was still in the group, but he was an A&R at the same time. And what Jason mentioned to KP, like, hey, man, me and Toomp had this artist that you need to listen to. And when KP heard him, first thing he did was put him on a PA record. Once everybody heard him for the first time, he was like, who the hell is this guy? He rap his ass off. Like, credible, you know? Southern draw with the New York patterns, you know what I mean? Like, you couldn't take the flow away from him. Sick. That was the whole introduction, you know, reintroduction. Because I've been knowing KP,
sure.
But that's when we basically joined forces on a whole nother level.
Did you feel vindicated in some way that someone from the organized noise, LaFace world, someone who was part of that successful crew in Atlanta, liked what you were doing?
Yeah, I felt pretty good. Heck yeah. Because you know how sometimes, man, you can have something and feel like, oh, this shit is hot. But you really don't know until you really move around with it.
Yeah.
And when I saw everybody's eyebrows going up to their hairline, I was like, okay, yeah, I got something going on here.
Yeah.
And what we really knew is when KP took him out to the Source Awards in L.A. And Source used to have this van, and they used to have just folks rapping. Just Tip went up there and kicked ass. Yeah, and everybody was talking about this little, who's a little red dude, man? Little light-skinned dude on the face, man. He's out of here, you know?
Yeah. But I'm Serious didn't really take off.
No, it didn't, man. You know, it was a lot going on at LaFace around that time, man. You know, the regular game of musical chairs in this industry, man. You see, like, L.A. just made another move. You feel me?
Right.
L.A. Reid, the Law, and LaFace Records made a move recently, but not a good one. He was fired from Epic Records in May after reports came out that he had sexually harassed an assistant.
Right.
So it's like around that time, that's when it was just up in the air, kind of like, okay, L.A. might be leaving soon or selling the label or whatnot. But it was just
hard to have a face without the love, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just a face, you know what I mean? And shit. But and it gave the company a whole nother face too, because really Tip was a part of, I would say, the last wave of artists that was signed. He may have been the last artist that was signed over there. And so when the company was sold, we really didn't have anybody really there to rah-rah for Tip's project, you know.
Did you actually print up singles of 24s yourself?
Yeah. That was before, 24s was after LaFace.
Okay, that was when we were on Atlantic already.
The I'm Serious album, that like I say, it did, yeah, you say it didn't do super, super good, but it definitely covered the Southeast to where we were still able to eat and get shows or whatnot. So, but the hottest record off that album was Dope Boys in the Trap.
So Dope Boys is the one you pressed out yourself.
Yep, did our own video to it and everything. Because L.A. didn't understand what they had at the time. He was like, what the hell is Dope Boys? What's a trap? You know what I mean? And we felt like, man, you know what? Instead of explaining everything, let's just print up some singles, do mixtapes, and put this shit out.
Right.
And because we know the label wasn't really behind us anymore. So we start feeling like, you know, independent all over again.
Yeah. Can you talk a second about, you had this whole idea for the sound of what would become trap music kind of in your head. Mm-hmm. And Tip was sort of the person to deliver it.
Right.
Where did that sound come from? How would you describe it? What were the elements of it?
Man, that sound really came from, first I would say the foundation of it, just the bass, the first level of it is what I've been doing, just with 808 drums. I just slowed down what I was, you know, I was like in 130 and 101, you know, 127 BPMs.
Right.
But I took those same drums and just slowed them down and just started putting more music into it, less samples. You know what I mean? A few horns or whatnot. But even at the time when I was doing that, we didn't call it trap music or anything. It was just a style, you know? And like I say, it was an influence. I would say it was an influence from a few things that was popping around that time. You had a little bit of the 3-6 Mafia. Got to give them their props. Like I say, some of that Texas flow with a little bit of East Coast delivery, you know, pattern-wise, you know?
Tight. These jealous niggas looking at me and my car so shife. Wanna take my life?
Shit is real and any day could be your last in the jungle. Get murdered on the humble, guns to blast, niggas tumble.
No more room in the VIP, they paying just to peek in. When they leave, they be looking in a car they can't even see in. And that's just the beginning in the city that he in. He wore rap in the cafeteria, but now that nigga serious. Heard he gotta see it.
But, you know, Tip never could sound like an East Coast guy. He's straight ATL, you know
right,
what I mean?
Just the accent alone.
Straight country boy could rap his ass off, you feel me? Yeah, man. And by the time, you know, it was time for the second project, like we said, we did 24s, man. And that was a track that was playing while I was cutting his hair.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I used to make beats, like, I get up like 10 in the morning, make a track. And my house, you know, was the house that everybody came to.
Yeah.
Just to post up, whether we look watching BET, Smoking Good. Or either just, you know, going through some beats or whatnot. You know, I had the MP, the Mackie board and all that set up in the room in the house.
Yeah. Tell me about Do It, because that was structurally, lyrically, that was something you modeled on Back That Ass Up, right?
Yes. It's all day, man. You got a great ear. You must be a DJ.
Unfortunately not. But,
you know something about music. You got a good ear just to keep that out. But definitely, I can 100% say Do It was an influence of Back That Ass Up, and that's some of that Manny Fresh. And it's like, me and Manny Fresh, you know, I sat down and talked to him, man, for a good little while after hanging with him, come to find out we started the same way. Same time, our same influence was Mantronic from up here. Mantronic was God to us, man, with the drum rolls and the whole repetitive 808 hi-hats or whatnot, the whole thing. So it was the influence of that.
The last time I talked to you, you said there was one particular song that really turned your head around, the Bass Machine.
Bass Machine, yeah. Mantronic featuring T. La Rock.
Yeah.
T. La Rock featuring Mantronic, either way. Yeah, Bass Machine.
What was it about that song?
Man, well, just first of all, the mix was like, it was something that in the car systems, like everybody wanted that. Because my homeboy Daz, my DJ partner, he was great at hooking up like car audio. So he had like 2 15s behind the seats and 4 12s. He took his whole back seat out of his Ford Tempo. And the shit sounded incredible, like shaking the whole neighborhood, literally. And that Bass Machine was just one of those records, man, with that low end. And then he had these, pep, 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 you know, the drum rolls. And man, we started doing the same thing on our SP-1200, including that same little style with some of that booty shake stuff. You know what I mean? And it was just in the edits. I think he had this guy named Shep Nunez who used to edit his stuff and chop it up. And that shit used to just sound like no other. That like after Mantronic would finish a record, he'd let Shep Nunez come chop it up and turn it into a mega mix.
Right.
Shep, I think Shep was up here too. It's from here also. Like him and the Latin Rascals, all of them used to just those
right,
Latin
the Latin
guys.
Rascal stuff, obviously.
Yeah, they knew how to edit their ass.
Mind blowing, yeah.
Yeah. And what's crazy, because Mantronic is the first guy that we just even know to even create music on a computer. You know what I mean? Everybody else was, at one point, had to splice tape, but I guess when the digital editing came out, yeah, Mantronic was one of the first guys really banging out. So, yeah, he's great influence. So, yeah, and once again, yeah, Do It was an influence to bag that ass up all day.
T.I.'s maybe best known song still is What You Know.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of yours. Did you ever actually hear the song that Benzino and Birdman made on that beat?
They played it to me once. I was dealing with this guy named Shank, and he happened to be cool with Benzino at the time. I think Shank used to do something with the Source magazine at one point. And I heard the song once, and I just wasn't moved by it, you know, because I always just... I mean, me and Benzino are super cool, but I always just looked at him as a executive, as a boss, like, you know, man, leave the rap stuff alone, man. You straight, dog. Just don't go in the booth no more, man. You a boss, man. Stop that shit, you know?
You're going to get me in trouble laughing at this.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool, though. I mean, ain't saying nothing. The same thing, you know. I mean, what, Birdman, he eventually learned how to rap for real. You know, he you know, being around rappers, Birdman couldn't do nothing but learn how to rap after a while.
Right,
you know
right.
what I mean? And get his flow right. Kind of like an Eazy-E. Mm-hmm. But Benzino, I always just like, man, I want to find somebody else to get his record to, you know?
Yeah. With you and Tip, what kind of contribution would he make on the musical side? And what kind of contribution would you make on flow lyrical side?
Well, see, the beautiful part is that Tip, you know, since he understand beats and was, you know, creating, you know, you can get Tip an MP and a Rolling Phantom, he'll go crazy with it. He can make some shit. So he always had the ear for it. So certain things that I would make, he'd be like, okay, break it down like this. Okay, and take this out right here. You know, he could really tell you how he wanted structured, because it's a certain way when he rapped or something, and when he get his pattern and he knows exactly where he wants it to break.
Yeah.
So that helps a lot from him being a rapper / producer.
Yeah. And you rapped a little bit on yourself.
Yeah,
on that Too Nasty record. You have
Too Nasty. I flow a little bit.
I'm a rapper. The love is for the singers. And no, by the way, are there any rings on my fingers? Yeah, right. I thought so, but if your feelings get hurt, it ain't my fault, yo.
That's crazy. First song me and Tip did was a song called Ball Like This. You know, strap like on forces, riding wide body Porsches. I'm staying cautious because these niggas got me nauseous, sick and paranoid, thinking somebody tried to get me. When a female stuck to me, I think she wanted to get me, trip me, set me off because I got a lot of cash in her. I got a lot of stash. My real stash is at a whole nother location. Want to see me, nigga? You got to take a vacation. I don't flex and try to buy that high price shit. Just the type of nigga that love to ride in nice shit. Is that a crime, nigga? Get me off your mind, nigga. All I do is make hot beats and rhyme, nigga. The house I'm living in is off some legal dividends. Y'all chose the wrong doors to be kicking in. But the niggas I roll with, the niggas I ball with, they bring them things in. They ride the trains in, nigga. They fly the planes in. See, I was really running around with some dudes around that time.
is that song out? Can you find it?
I think Tip might be the only one with a copy of that. Maybe him or Doug.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't even hardly remember the lyrics, but yeah. But that was a song that I did. I had a Roland 1680. And at that point, I was like, man, you know what? I got beats. I'm getting ready to rap, too. That's the only way. Because I felt that was the best way to get my beats heard is by turning this shit into a song. And he got on it, man. His verse was so cool. Oh, my God. I thought I bodied it. He bodied that shit. Ain't no thing here. All we do is slang here. Something came here. 97 service sitting on them things here. And something. We just ball, shawty. I ain't got no problem spending 300 and spending at the mall, shawty. I'm going to get a quarter piki and I'm going to sell it all, shawty. Anybody want to get high, they know the call, shawty. I can't remember. Hey, man, Tip killed that shit. I can't remember his verse. But yeah, man. Wow. But I was almost taking that shit seriously because I was rapping about real life stuff because I had one foot off in there. I was playing around, you know, just shit I learned from being around, you know, hustlers and whatnot. So right. Yeah, got some little extra tax free.
Wow. You know, I do have to ask a little bit about the graduation era, or I guess maybe it was called Good Ass Job at the time you were working on it, era Kanye, working on that record. You were around for a lot of the making of it, even beyond Big Brother and Good Life and Can't Tell Me Nothing, right? What were those sessions like?
Man, well, first, I'm going to tell you, that whole Kanye story is so funny, man, because we were actually up here the first time we linked up. End up going to the studio and we was playing around on the ASR-10 and I made a beat right on the spot. And all of a sudden that mug just zipped out. Boom. Error reboot. 003 or whatever that shit say. And I had we missed our first flight. So it was like 3 hours until, you know, the next joint. So yeah. And once Ye saw me put that track together on the ASR-10, which was a famous keyboard that everybody used to this day. You know, I can name a long list. I still got mine. He knew that I, you know, brought some cool shit to the table. But what's crazy, we had already met, too, during trap music. Because Kanye had, like, three songs on that album.
Look, from when the moon came out till the sun came up, I was supplying the days when would they flame up. My mama's passing by, trying to explain us. Pissing in the bushes like they never house trained us. But try to understand.
Kanye is officially credited on 2 tracks, Doing My Job and Let Me Tell You Something.
You know what y'all think, you know? First he can't be my man, now he wanna be my man. I wish this nigga make his mind up, like, I can dig a dip out with me. All my niggas, man, we gon' have to be 21 about this shit, you know? We gon' step out of the trap. Hey, one sec, hey, know what I got to say.
And he was playing some of his music to us.
Oh, so you got to hear the first batch of his solo stuff.
Yeah, when he decided to become the full-fledged artist, he was playing some of our stuff. I was like, man, what y'all think? We was like, man, thumbs up. That shit hot, dog. You know, what you gonna do? And next thing you know, man, we Kanye West.
Yeah.
Producer/artist, man. And come on, look what you got.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Incredible guy. And Jeezy, I did a record for Jeezy called I Got Money. It's featuring him and T.I.
My seat is sway, my luggage is Louis. And every bitch in the projects won't do me.
I got money.
So Kanye heard the song and was crazy about the music, but said that, hey man, that's the feel I want. I want to do something like that. So Kanye wanted to remix the record, but instead we ended up making it one of our records. And that was my first time ever just emailing tracks back and forth. So he'll send me something and I sent him an idea. He started putting different things on it. So we used my drum track, bass line, and we just started building, man. And next thing you know, from that record, man, we ended up, when he decided to do his next album, he wanted to come down here and actually do it with me from beginning to end.
That first song you were working on, was that ever finished?
Yeah, it ended up being Can't Tell Me Nothing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
can't tell me nothing right. Excuse me.
Yeah, I got money. It turned from an I Got Money remix to Can't Tell Me Nothing.
Wow.
Ain't that some shit?
Amazing.
Hey, man. Big record.
Yeah. Obviously the biggest. Yeah. And then, right. And Jeezy ends up on the remix, ironically.
Damn right.
Bring it full circle.
Yeah, man.
If I had $1 billion, yeah, I'd spend it all today. Show these niggas how to play. Top floor penthouse, I'll show them where I stay.
It all made sense.
Yeah. Can't Tell Me Nothing. The voice on it, singing while he's rapping.
Yeah.
I had a dream I could buy my way to heaven. When I awoke, I spent that on a necklace. I told God I'll be back in a second. Man, it's so hard not to act reckless.
That's not a sample.
Nope, it's not a sample. Everybody swear that's a sample.
Yeah.
Don't you know I get asked that?
Do you get people who think they know where it's from?
Man,
they can't even think that.
Really, more than them saying that where it come from, they're asking like, what is that? And who is it and what is it? Because some people, you can't tell if it's a male or female to a certain degree. But then when they get money, baby. So it's just an effect. They just chose the right effect, you know, to put on the vocals, man, to give it that. Yeah.
Do you remember who sang it?
I can't remember. Ye told me a while back, but it was, I can't remember the young lady.
The voice belongs to South African-born singer-songwriter Connie Mitchell of the group Sneaky Sound System.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Masterpiece, man. Very strong record.
Unbelievable. One of the crazy things about Good Life that I read is that T-Pain was not the original choice for the hook.
Nah, man, we went through a few people. At John Legend. Shoot, I brought a homegirl in. I can't think of her name, but I brought her in to try it. Because, you know, we were right there in Atlanta, so I was able to just make calls and say, hey, you know, I'm down here with Kanye. You know, I'm giving you a chance. Don't ever say ain't did shit for you. You know, come on down to Doppler, you know, and try to get on this record. We trying to figure out how to do the hook.
And what did you learn from being around that kind of perfectionism?
Man, I learned a whole lot being around Kanye. I learned a lot about, even though I started with a DJ, I mean, with a production team, well, ODS, that was me, Mike Fresh, and Kool Kali. But I truly, truly learned the next level of production, and that's just bringing in just people who are really great at stuff. You know, I could be good at making the beats. I could be great at the beats and great at sampling. Why should I sit there and just try to play some pianos? You know, I might put the basic melody down, but nah, fuck it, man. Let's bring a real piano player in here. You know what I mean? A real keyboard player in here. Oh, I also come from the era of not letting people hear anything until it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Ye was like, nah. Because first we started off in my studio. I got a little studio in the West End, but my production room is like just a perfect square
footage. I heard about this. He made you move because you couldn't fit enough girls in the
damn
studio.
Damn right. Hey, man. Yeah, you know your shit, man. Check you. Hell yeah.
Incredible story.
Yeah, because
incredible.
He was like, you know, the first day we got in there, we was banging. You know, he was like, yeah, you know. He say, so Toomp, ain't gonna lie, man, you know, I want to bring some girls in later on, man. You know, I like just let them listen to what we doing just to see where we are. You know, I'm like, oh, shit, okay, I've never done this. Like I said, I'm used to coming from the era to where nobody don't hear it until that shit go to mastering. You feel me?
Yeah.
And so he was like, he said, where would the girls go? I was like, man, we really don't have enough room. So that's when we went to Doppler. And that was my first, like I say, first experience of working with a producer slash artist who don't mind bringing, you know, outside people in just to get their opinions on it.
Is that something you adopted afterwards?
I haven't really had that much control over a project to do that yet, but hopefully I will.
Right.
Next time that is a project that I may be executive or co-executive, I would love to do the same thing because that plays a major part, man. And, you know, I mean, you just got females who straight out the club or wherever. It's just, you know, hey, baby, come on. You know what? You like Kanye? Real? Yeah. Invite you to the studio. This ain't even no groupie shit. Like, you know, we just want to lend your ear for a minute. Lend
right.
us your ear. And borrow your ear, rather. And yeah, and it was dope because we narrowed it down, man. And we took out certain things and put in certain things. And Good Life was one of those songs that the women were like, oh my God, we love that. We love that. And that's when he started talking, you know, different. He even made it, changed his verse. Once he saw how many females liked that record, he really made that verse cater to the females, you know. Naming the body parts and all that cool shit.
Hey, welcome to the good life. Where we like
the girls who ain't on TV because they got more
ass than the models.
The good life, so keep it coming with the
body. He sucked the energy up from them and boom, that shit was magic, man.
Wow.
I got to catch up with Kanye, man. I haven't seen that guy in years.
Right.
Like, I don't have any contacts with him. I would love to catch up with him right now on this new joint. I could tell he's the, you know, family man. You know, if through life, everybody hit their reset button. So I would love to catch him, you know, during his reset time.
Yeah, it's been about 10 years since the
10-year anniversary. Yeah. I'm actually trying to put a good graduation anniversary event together. I just got to catch up with him.
Man.
Yeah, I think that shit will be incredible.
One last graduation thing is I've got about Big Brother, and you know, two things about it I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
First off, that it started out you sampling a song from that I don't remember if it was the first, but one of the first Prince albums.
Yeah.
Stadium status. My big brother was Big's brother. Used to be Dame and Big's brother. Who was hip-hop brother? Who was no ID friend? No ID my mentor. And I let the story begin. It's the hard knock.
It wasn't even a sample. I just replayed it. I always, first of all, I'm super big Prince fan. Been a fan of Prince since the late 70s, man, since the first album. And it was a song called It's Gonna Be Lonely.
You know, I had never occurred to me, but then once I found that out, I listened back and I was like, oh, this makes perfect sense. Same like distorted guitar, piano.
There you go. Yeah.
Kind of vibe.
That's one of my secrets with my production, man, you know, is it ain't all about sampling. Sometimes I just let the record play, you know, before I even get started on beats and just listen to feel and the progressions and instruments, the way it's mixed, where certain guitars are sitting and the texture. And, you know, with us having the accessibility of all the plugins and softwares, man, you know, we could simulate almost anything on the airwaves right now. And like I say, from being a Prince fan, one of my secrets is I notice the end of a lot of records are the best part.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like the last bite of a hamburger and shit.
Yeah.
If somebody knock it out your hand, you raise hell. Like, yo, you could have did this shit earlier and I would have been mad. But this last bite, so the end of a record does, you know, from what you know. Good life to a long list of them, man. The end part is the part that really moves me. And yeah, I replayed that record. And at first he said no. Then when we got to New York to finish the album, he said, yeah, but I want all the publishing.
That happens sometimes with super big stars. We had a similar story with 80 Keys and Paul McCartney.
Okay.
Paul McCartney wanted all or 98% or whatever it was. In exchange for a sample.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what's wild is what I did, because I had two Macs at that point. So I thought, I just thought everything was cool because, you know, we had everything on tape, you know, all the stems or whatnot. So when we got the news that he wanted 100%, I was like, yo, and Ye was like, yo, man, you know, so let's do it, man. 100%, man. I was like, nah, bro, that's how I eat.
Right.
I would rather go back
home. That's one of 12 songs on an album for him.
Yeah, man. And shoot, the last song on the album, that was the last record we was mixing too.
Yeah.
And what happened, Def Jam flew me back to Atlanta because I left that particular Mac at home. Matter of fact, that was a shout out to Propeller Heads. That was done on Reason 3. 3 or 4, either way, it was Reason.
Yeah.
And I went back. I'm talking about I was home. I was actually in Atlanta for 2 hours. So the limo came and got me from the airport, took me to my studio in the West End. I went upstairs, plugged that shit up, used my Roland Phantom as a controller, and just kept listening to it. I was like, yo, I got to move these notes around. I'm going to use the same instruments, but I got to change the melody. And I got to make sure that it still fits with Kanye's vocals. Man, so it took me about an hour and a half. I'm looking at the camera. Okay, limo still down there with his lights on. And by the time I finished it, man, I closed the computer up, got a limo. He was like, you ready? And went right back to Hartsfield Airport. So basically, just snuck into the crib. Like, I could have committed a crime, man. Nobody wouldn't even know. I'd be like, I was in New York. You know what I mean? So I got back up here, and I forgot what studio we was at. Damn it, man. I should shoot myself in the toe. But all I know is, man, is the whole thing. It was like a drum roll moment. Like, hey, Toon, you know, I hope this shit sounds as good as the first one. Because, you know, people can get demo-itis and fall in love with the first version. But man, when I hit play and a lot of the Def Jam people were there and Ye came in and I was like, yo, I told the engineer, hey man, line this music up. Don't change the mix. Just get the files of this music and put this with the beat.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody hearing until you mix, get a rough mix on it. And he got it together and turned it up, man. Everybody was like, yo, this is the shit. We like this even better. So boom, I own all my publishing on that now, you know.
Yeah.
Shout out to Prince still, though, you know, for the energy, man, you know, rest in peace.
Of course, of course. And one wild thing about that song is you were actually in the room the first time Jay-Z heard it.
Yes, I was there. Man, I wish we had. You know what? It's man, believe it or not, man, Kanye have footage. He had a video guy filming that whole process of us making the graduation project.
That's on tape somewhere.
So I'm hoping, man, that he would do something on the 10-year anniversary and just say, let me put this video out. Let me sell this
even
shit to
just
HBO.
That 10 minutes would be,
man,
know.
10 minutes. His video guy was there every day from Georgia to New York.
Wow.
That shit could be like a 2-hour documentary, and I promise everybody would be stuck just from it being a classic album with Grammy records on there. But yeah, I was there, man, because what it was, see, the conversation was, oh, Kanye got a new song talking about Jay. Jay didn't know if it was a diss record or what. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on. You know, what did I do type shit? You know what I mean? Right. So him and Jay Brown came up there, man. And
who was also mentioned in the record.
Yeah.
Then I went and told Jay Brown, should have known that was going to come back around.
Jay Brown, you know, he's with Roc Nation to this day, man. Super good people, man. Shout out to Jay, both Jays rather. And when he came in, man, it was like, yeah, let's hear this shit, man. And so they turned it up. I'm sitting in the corner, Jay sitting in there, you know, Jay Brown in his little corner. And when the song came on, man, you know, Jay sat in front of the speakers and we heard it word for word. When the song went off, it was just quiet. Jay turned around like, that's how you feel, man. And Ye was, you know, he's like, Ye tried to kind of kept himself like occupied with something, like he didn't want to just look at everybody.
Right.
But that moment, man, that was like a magic moment. I promise it was.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. Because everybody, like I say, when you hear people talk about it, they were like, oh, he got a song talking about Jay. People didn't know what it was. And of course, you know, if it was some disrespectful shit, Jay was going to be like, hey, man, you got to change that up.
Right.
He never knows how
his
everybody.
Label at the time,
people,
right?
Let me tell you, out of everybody in this rap game, people be real careful what they say about Jay. Jay got long, you know, he got reach, you know what I mean? And, you know, and I don't know, allegedly they say he's been known to, you know, have people fired or whatnot. So, and then that's power, you know what I mean? So, yeah, folks, really be careful. I even watch Breakfast Club. They'll talk about everybody but Jay-Z, bro. They watch their motherfucking mouth when it comes to Sean Carter, I tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did want to ask about you and Nas, too, because you have the Slave and the Master song with him.
They say we in our double G-E-R. We are much more. Still, we choose to ignore the obvious. Man, this history don't acknowledge us. We were scholars long before colleges.
When can we hear the unreleased Nas songs you have? I know you have two on deck somewhere.
Man, yeah, Nas got a few joints, man. I don't know if it's in his hard drive or I don't know if it's still in Def Jam's possession. Most likely, I think Nas still got his tapes, but I don't know, man. Because last time I saw Nas was at an event some years ago. And I'm like, yo, I told him straight up, I'm like, man, if you ever want to do just an album, I don't know who would distribute it or how would it go, or if you want to do a mixtape, I would gladly do that. We could do this at my studio, you know. Yeah. He was like, yeah, you know, because he was in Atlanta a little bit for a while. You know, he was kind of, I think he was living down there for a while. Yeah, I was just hoping I could just kidnap him one day and do a mixtape or either just release those records. But I'm slowly, you know, thinking about putting an album together, man, and because I got an unreleased, I got another version to help. I got like two or three Jay-Z records that haven't been heard. It's one with him and Rihanna that's crazy.
Oh.
I know I ain't supposed to be talking about this shit, man. But, yo, it's crazy. I only heard it one time, man. This young lady, Miss Kwok, let me hear that shit once. And she was like, all right, you heard it once. All right, give it back.
That's it. Yeah, right.
You know, I hope you didn't have anything recording it. But, yeah, I got some exclusive records. Man, I got like unreleased joints on Jigga. I mean, on shit from Nas to, not to mention how many unreleased Tip records, yeah. Jeezy. You know what I mean? I got a few unreleased records on a lot of artists.
As someone who pioneered what came to be called trap music, mm-hmm. right? And came to be called trap music because of an album that you
right.
played a huge role in, executive produced and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of what people call trap music today? Do you see any connection with the stuff you were doing?
I kind of see it with the drums and how they put it together. Because it's the same instruments. It's a little bit busier, I would say.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't really hear what are now called trap hi-hats, the super, super fast, almost rolls.
Yeah.
I don't really hear that from you till Who Wants Some.
Oh, man. Nah, I had it on a few joints. You listen to some of those old bass records, you could definitely
hear it. You can hear that?
Yeah. On Do It. Boom.
Yeah,
there's a few drum rolls on that.
But so do you see a connection between modern trap and
honestly, to this day, I'm still wondering how they came up with that name. I don't know, because I mean, I've been loving that style of music, but by the time I heard, talked to a few DJs, they was like, yeah, they call that trap. I'm like, for real? Why? I'm like, that's trap music? I'm like, what are they talking about? Are they rapping about trapping and whatnot? So, it's wild. Just like, it's almost the same thing with mixtapes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When mixtapes is from a DJ mixer mm-hmm. doing tricks and maybe, a few pause mixes or whatever. And that was a mixtape because the records are being mixed. But then mixtape became really an album that was not released professionally or a rapper over somebody else's instrumentals.
Yeah.
With no mixes. And so, you know what I mean? So it's just funny. I just had to adapt to what the industry, how they could just change things, Just like they go, what was it called? It was a dance they called the Harlem Shake mm-hmm. recently.
But
it wasn't the same Harlem Shake that we saw.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I guess, these kids will take shit and remix it and do what they do. But, but respect, though. I love the movement and the fact that people could still associate something that I've done, back in 2003 and with what's happening in 2017,
Yeah.
That's, I'm appreciative of that. That's dope.
Speaking of remixing things and of things that shake, mm-hmm. You had an early song, Shake It. With Shy D,
yeah.
Come on, girl, don't try to fake it.
Get out there
and let me see you shake it.
Shake it.
Yes, yes, shake it. Yes, 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 shake it. Yes, yes, shake it. Yes, 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 shake it. Yes.
What was it like maybe 10 years later when Laker Girl started dancing to it?
Man, I was tripping because of, like you say, those 10 years later, I had to learn the game. I'm like, oh my God, my licensing checks.
I got to make some phone calls.
Oh my
here,
God, yeah. Yeah, but I didn't have
no
business.
Oh, you didn't have nothing,
then.
Yeah.
I didn't know that shit then. Yeah, even though stuff released professionally, I didn't do no right paperwork on that,
right.
But yeah, it was a lot that went on back then too, because, of course, out of the whole crew, Shotty was the only one with solid paperwork. So when he decided to sue Luke for like $1 million, me and Mike Fresh didn't get anything from that.
Shy D sued Luther Campbell in 1990 for non-payment of royalties. Shy D's lawyer offered to settle for $150,000, but Luke declined. The judge ruled that Campbell owed Shy D $2.3 million. Oops.
So that was kind of like one of those situations. It was like, okay, yeah, I definitely got it. You know what I mean? So all that came into play just from the whole movement. That's why I always look at that. It's much love to Luke. You know what I mean? He was at my 40th birthday in Miami. It was me, him, Kanye, Fat Joe, who's at Club Live, brought my 40th in like no other. You know what I mean? Hopefully my 50th will be the same. And it's always been love, man. Me and Luke always could sit and talk like men, but that's why I can never blame him or anybody else. That was just really me. You know what I mean? That's what a lot of cats, I think they should do, really. Don't sit back whether it's music or whatever in life, when you really boil most of the shit down, you got to look at the guy in the mirror, Yeah.
So there is a Shy D track mm-hmm. to take it back to there. Just one final thing. There's a Shy D track on, I think, the second album you did with him. called I Don't Want to Treat You Wrong. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That had a Between the Sheets sample.
Yeah, we was ahead of my time.
Are you the first person you remember using that sample?
Yeah, we were the first ones to use Between the Sheets. Yeah. Matter of fact, we didn't even have a sampler because we had no S950. We had the SP1200. We're only 10 seconds of sampling time. So, which that we used so much. And matter of fact, we got away with a lot of shit back then, too. You know, the whole sample clearing thing. Was.
Right. I mean, I'm not blowing up your spot. That's a pretty well-known sample.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I guess they figure, oh, those guys, you know, around. Those guys sold about 300,000. That ain't nothing major.
Right. Now you talk. You know,
right. I do. I've interviewed him. It's a pretty good Ron Isley impression.
Yeah, man. So it's like instead of sampling, I had to cue it in and keep it on beat. You know, use my DJ skill.
Actually, spin.
That's why every time they come in, it's like boom, boom. Yeah. So a lot of us, even in the 87, 88, we weren't, you know, long when it comes to a record playing long, nobody had samplers that can really just stay on beat that long. So we had to cue it in and keep it on beat and then turn it down. You know what I mean? So that was like the old school way of doing it, man.
Yeah. And you do a lot for the producer community. You do a lot of videos. You go to conferences.
Yeah.
A bunch of things like that. Why?
I love it, man. I love it. This is still fun. I love being around other producers and just other musicians who just have that same passion, man. You know, I've been loving this since I was old enough to drop the needle on a record. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was a kid. My dad taught me how to sing.
Yeah.
But right while I'm listening to records, man, I'm just picking up the album covers, looking at everybody's outfits, reading who the producer is, who played what. I knew all the members of Commodores just from seeing who played what, Walter Orange and McLaren and all them, all the different guys. I'm like, oh, okay, he played the percussion, he played the drums, he's on the bass. So I was in third, fourth grade. I paid attention to all that stuff, man, and I really didn't know where it was leading to, but I knew it was something just from that love. And when I hear some of these young cats' story, I'm the guy who they was reading on the album covers, like, oh, DJ Toomp, I want to meet him one day. Oh, he's executive producer. He did my favorite record. So it's kind of like, and when I hear them say that, I'm like, damn, I was reading the covers the same way. And I could tell, youngin', you know, you love this shit the way I do. And so that's why, honestly, I don't have no problems showing up at conferences, man, and dropping, you know, gems and jewels on cats, man, who I see, you know, who actually love it. And I don't have no problem learning either. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's the passion, man. I love it. It's my thing.
And what's going on right now with DJ Toomp? What are you working on?
Right now, man, believe it or not, communicating with some people who I made hits with, you know. I started to communicate with Jeezy more. Me and Tip starting to communicate a lot more. Working with my man Cassius up here, co-executive of his project. Cassius, he wrote Just the Way You Are for Bruno Mars. He's an incredible artist /writer, musician. Been playing the piano since he was a kid, so he's incredibly dope. So it's a few things with him, man. I'm working on his project, but at the same time, from him being an incredible songwriter, ain't no telling where some of the songs may be on his albums, or they may be on Bruno's next album. Shit, yeah. You know. Slowly getting into the software side of things. You know, trying to come up with a few apps and devices. You know, to entertain, you know, the music industry. You know, one thing I noticed in life is, man, really, you know, you don't want to get too caught up into what you've been doing for the past 30 years. You got to shift gears. And honestly, you know, you got to think about it. You got folks, let's just say I can make money from the NFL more than being an actual player. Let's say I come up with a right helmet that'll keep guys from having concussions. I'll make more than the average player out there on the field. So the same thing how they got the dude who came up with Napster. He don't know how to work a drum machine or no shit about production or music, but he came up with something to where he can make money from the industry.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So that's what I'm focusing on now is paying attention to what musicians and consumers want and producers and just, you know, want to offer some things, man. Just like how Dre did, you know, those headphones, he made money from the industry.
Yeah.
You know, he made great money in the industry too, but he made way more selling the industry some headphones.
Yeah.
You feel me?
Yeah.
So it's just like, yeah, it's a lot of ways that you can get creative with that. You know, I don't think I would get into the headphone game. That's already been done. So it's a lot of other things that I'm working on slowly with some of my guys down here at some of these tech buildings in Atlanta. Atlanta has definitely become a strong city as when it comes to the tech. There's some students down there. Got some incredible things on the way, man. And I'm trying to be a part of all that.
Awesome. Well, DJ Tube, thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me, man. Incredible, man.
All right.
And New York is incredible. I love this city, man.
One of my favorite things to do on this show is to talk to producers. While they have such an incredibly important role in creating the hip-hop we know and love, they rarely get a chance to tell their side of things. Toomph, for someone so instrumental in the making of so many important styles and songs, hasn't had that much of a chance to talk about his style or his influences. I feel fortunate also to have gotten such a close look at two of his important creative partnerships, with Kanye West and, of course, with T.I. Tip and Toomph have done so much together, and I think after listening to this interview, you have a pretty good idea as to why. The Cypher will be on our usual summer schedule for July and August, bringing you shows every other week. So join us in 2 weeks on July 31st, when our guest will be the one and only Shaggy. Mr. Boombastic himself joins us to talk his early days in Flatbush, his biggest hits, and a whole lot more. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with another iconic Atlanta rap figure, Jermaine Dupri, on episode 167. Whatever you use to listen to this show, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow to sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share extra audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some special extra material. Join us by the end of July to have access to August's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Anybody want to get high, they know to call Shawty.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, there's nothing I would play for my daughter.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Yeah, man, I want to find somebody else to get this record to.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Damn it, man, I should shoot myself in the toe.
Audio assistance by Rob Van Vranken.
It almost turned me into a whore, but I discipline myself.
Additional audio consulting by Florence Barrow Adams.
Southern drawl with the New York patterns, you know what I mean?
Special thanks to Patreon supporter JoJo Pexon.
Rich as hell, you hear me? Getting it.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Do it.